Yes, we are burning down the house here at heritageradionetwork.com. But you already knew that because you found us through the genius of the internet worldwide. Friends and listeners from Finland to Australia, all across the United States. And I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host and friendly guide to this world of design, architecture, and the creative arts here every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. This episode, number 42, are we 42 or 41? One, thank you. It's brought to you by Acme Smoked Fish. Located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Acme has been a mainstay in New York's culinary landscape for over 55 years. Using old world recipes, Acme produces the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, sable, that discerning palates demand. For information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill Bay, or Ruby Bay products, visit www.acmesmokedfish.com. That's acmesmokedfish.com. North America's leading producer of smoked seafood. Thank you very much, Acme. Well, here on Heritage Radio Network, the name of the mystic, sculptor, and architect, Rudolf Steiner, frequently comes up. Mostly on the other programs, apropos of his having invented what's called biodynamic farming. And we'll get into that later. But I've been thinking about Steiner and the period of time in which he was most productive and prolific across many different cultural trends, which was about 100 years ago. During that period from 1900 to 1925, Steiner went from one discipline to the next. Let me read you a little bit about his background. I suppose people who have children in school will know of the Waldorf schools. Steiner invented the Waldorf school system. So we have the Rudolf Steiner School in New York City. It carries forward the ideas about education that Steiner developed. The first Waldorf school was at the Waldorf Astoria Cigarette Factory, oddly enough, named after the Waldorf Astoria hotel guy. And so they became the Waldorf schools. And one of the aspects of a Waldorf education that I find fascinating, because I was the recipient to a certain degree of collegiate level education that drew very heavily from Steiner's ideas, which can be summed up that everything informs everything else. So, for example, if you're studying fractions in arithmetic class, you might learn fractions better by studying musical intervals, octaves, thirds, and fifths. And another aspect which involves music very heavily is that in between academic classes, and there should be movement. And one of the aspects of Waldorf education is eurythmy, in which the children and the teachers get up on their feet, and they have free-form movement, with the idea being that you learn and then you move, and then your brain will retain that lesson much more readily. And also, if you're dealing with small children, you know, they have their restless moments. And that's one of the ideas that informs how I attempt to arrange our little conversations here on Burning Down the House, where we talk a little, and then we play some music. So, Dan, would you roll track two, please?
Ooh.
Eurythmics. Wouldn't have the Eurythmics, Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart, if you hadn't had Rudolf Steiner and Eurythmics. Sweet dreams. Sweet dreams to my sister, Constance Ann, who departed, who shuffled off this mortal coil last Friday. Lost one of my best friends. She is in a sweeter place. This evening's program of Burning Down the House is engineered by Dan Brindell. Andrea Trabuco Campos, buonasera, signore, is doing tagging and producing. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome. Steiner, such a rich topic. What a character. He invented this syncretic blend of mysticism and science called anthroposophy. And that becomes important in an architectural way because he blended it with an institute and a building dedicated to the writings of the playwright and poet Goethe. So there's a very important building called the Goetheanum. You know, in many, many places in the United States, you'll see an art museum or a literary building called an Athenaeum, or a temple to Athena, the goddess of wisdom. So this is the Goetheanum, dedicated to the philosophy of Goethe. And so in addition to the Waldorf schools, there's this whole anthroposophical heritage that Rudolf Steiner left. I mean, it was a very rich time, and one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this period of time is that I feel that in our current time here in 2010, we do not have the cross-creative dialogue that we see in the history of Central Europe at that time 100 years ago, where sculptors and philosophers and painters and architects were all exchanging ideas. I mean, to a certain extent, that happens here at Heritage Radio Network, where we have chefs, we have beer guys, we have an architect, we have a naturalist, we have a financial person, we have many, many farmers coming in, and we all talk to each other, and we exchange ideas, and hey, I get ideas listening to Chef Dave Arnold's cooking issues. I get a lot of ideas. I mean, it's really, it's great that we have this dialogue happening here at Heritage Radio Network, which is one of the things that makes us a force not to be denied. And with the internet, our message is going all over the world, which is a wonderful, and it's a gratifying thing that we can, you know, share what we know in sort of the way that Rudolf Steiner, through his activities, has left a huge legacy. Now, the Goetheanum is interesting because it's part of German Expressionism. That's a trend that's very much related to what we call Art Nouveau or Jugendstil, and very close in terms of aesthetic roots of organic forms to the work of the Vienna Secession, and we'll get to them in a couple moments. But they're all part of this this whole piece of everything informs everything else, which is what makes a Waldorf education really a rich experience. And of course, we can't talk about the Waldorf schools without mentioning Karl Orff, who comes a little bit later into the 20th century, who's most famous for his sort of cantata called Carmina Burana. But also in the Waldorf schools, Orff devised some simplified musical instruments that were easily accessible to children, not too difficult, to help them understand those intervals of thirds, fifths, and octaves, which then inform their understanding of arithmetic. So let's have the next track from Orff's O Fortuna from Carmina Burana.
Yeah.
Excellent. Superb. So we are Burning Down the House, brought to you by Acme Fish. For over 55 years, the foremost provider of smoked seafood in North America. Sourcing only the highest quality materials from around the globe, Acme has been a sustainable steward of the seafood industry. From traditional smoked salmon to fine delicacies like smoked sable and trout, Acme is the authority on smoked fish. For more information on the Acme Blue Hill Bay or Ruby Bay brands, visit acmesmokedfish.com. Thank you. Thank you very much. I love smoked fish. I just can't get enough of it. But then, you know, I'm a freak. I like any kind of fish. Sushi, smoked sable, herring. I played O Fortuna for a reason, to set a tone, an acoustic tone, for what these times that we're talking about around the beginning of the 20th century sounded like. O Fortuna itself has a text from medieval Latin. It's a long, long, long poem, and Karl Orff set it to music, and it's really evocative music. So there was this mysticism of Rudolf Steiner and a certain amount of medievalism going on all at the same time as down a little bit further in Central Europe in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. In Vienna, we had Sigmund Freud, who was developing psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. It's very rich times. And I believe that all of these ideas inform each other. Now, just a little bit before this anthroposophy stuff got going with Steiner, we had a really interesting group of artists and architects together in Vienna. And they were kind of fed up with the eclecticism of the late 19th century. They were done with doing buildings decorated with neoclassical ornaments ripped off from the Greeks and the Romans. And so they decided that they would just simply secede. They would just quit. They called their movement the Vienna Secession, or in German, the Vereinigung Bildender Künstler Österreich, which means the Union of Austrian Artists. And they built themselves a really beautiful and quite stunningly different looking headquarters building called the Wiener Künstlerhaus. And I mean, interestingly enough, Gustav Klimt was their first president. Klimt, who we know for his paintings of the sexy half-naked women, where he's got a play of space. And the paintings go flat, and then this face emerges from it. Wonderful, swirly, Art Nouveau kind of little curlicues and lots of gold leaf, sparkly pictures. Here in New York, you can see some of the best Klimt paintings if you go to the Neue Gallery on Fifth Avenue, around, I believe it's 89th Street. That is definitely worth a trip in and of itself to see all of those German and Austrian works from this period. Just all, as they say in German, zeitgebundet, or bound in time, where these ideas are flowing back and forth between people like Steiner and Klimt and Freud and Otto Wagner, doing then some really wonderful early modern work. And let me see now. I got so carried away, I lost my notes. And another sound, and another a little bit more romantic, but certainly evocative trend that was happening, was the wonderful music of Richard Strauss, a German composer. Let's have track 4 from Also sprach Zarathustra.
Thank you.
course, you cinema buffs will recognize that from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, a little bit more on the Vienna Secession. The frieze above the entrance has this wonderful inscription. Of course, it's in German, but the translation is, "To every age, it's art, and to art, it's freedom." What a wonderful, wonderful expression. So as life will often present us with challenges, some of the members of the secession drifted off and did their own thing, one of whom was the designer Josef Hoffmann. He also did architecture. And he founded the Viennese workshop, or in German, the Wiener Werkstätte. And you know, everything from chairs to silver tableware. If you go to the Neue Gallery, you will see these things. They are still in production. You can buy these wonderful expressionistic. And by that I mean the artistic trend called expressionism, which includes also the Norwegian painter Munch's stuff. It's the next logical development after, Impressionism. The Wiener Werkstätte was a very important thing. And so there was all these ideas going around. I mean, these days, today, I don't see architects hanging out with hip-hop guys. But I think they should, because I think that we could actually learn something about structure from the way that hip-hop and house music is structured. I think we can learn a lot, really, about counterpoint and balance and scale by listening to Richard Strauss, or, for that matter, the Eurythmics. And that's why, as I have talked before, music informs a pattern of thinking. And that is important, I think, for us architects to open ourselves to not only music, but to poetry and to dance, to eurythmy, because all of these things inform each other. And I would like to promote more interplay between the creative arts. I think our culture would be much enriched, and I think our architecture would be much enriched. Too many architects just talk to architects, and live an interior life, which is terribly limiting. So this was a very, very rich time. Just, contemporaneous with Steiner's designing the Goetheanum, we had Richard Strauss composing a comic opera called Der Rosenkavalier. Let's have about 4 minutes of waltzes as conducted by the New York Philharmonic. Thank you. And so, as the waltz goes on, I want to talk just briefly about another German writer of this period, Rainer Maria Rilke, who's not exactly contemporaneous, but he certainly expresses a lot of the same ideas of attempting to get some sort of enlightenment that is at once magical and mystical, and also at the same time grounded in the science of psychology. And here's a really sweet and thought-provoking little essay, which I'm going to read from Rilke. Fear of the inexplicable. But fear of the inexplicable has not alone impoverished the existence of the individual. The relationship between one human being and another has also been cramped by it, as though it had been lifted out of the riverbed of endless possibilities and set down in a fallow spot on the bank to which nothing happens. For it is not inertia alone that is responsible for human relationships repeating themselves from case to case, indescribably monotonous and unrenewed. It is shyness before any sort of new, unforeseeable experience with which one does not think oneself able to cope. But only someone who is ready for everything, who excludes nothing, not even the most enigmatical, will live the relation to another as something alive, and will himself draw exhaustively from the individual as a larger, draw exhaustively from his own existence. For if we think of the existence of the individual as a larger or smaller room, it appears evident that most people learn to know only a corner of their room, a place by the window, a strip of floor on which they walk up and down. Thus they have a certain security. And yet that dangerous insecurity is so much more human, which drives the prisoners in Poe's story to feel out the shapes of their horrible dungeons and not be strangers to the unspeakable terror of their abode. We, however, are not prisoners. No traps or snares are set about us. There is nothing which should intimidate or worry us. We are set down in life as in the element to which we best correspond. And over and above this, we have through thousands of years of accommodation become so like this life that when we hold still, we are through happy mimicry, scarcely to be distinguished from all that surrounds us. I mean, there's a real Steiner idea where everything informs everything else. We have no reason to mistrust our world, for it is not against us. Has it terrors? They are our terrors. Has it abysses? Those abysses belong to us. Are dangers at hand? We must try to love them. And if only we arrange our life according to that principle which counsels us that we must always hold to the difficult, then that which now still seems to us the most alien will become what we most trust and find most faithful. How should we be able to forget those princesses? Perhaps all the dragons of our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us, once beautiful and brave. Perhaps everything terrible is in its deepest being, something helpless that wants help from us. That's very resonant with the ideas of anthroposophy, where science is going to lead us to a religious epiphany. I mean, it's an interesting idea. The anthroposophical people are still around. You can read all about them. And then, my friends, we get to Rudolf Steiner's invention of biodynamic farming, which is a term that is much bruited about here in Studio A of HeritageRadioNetwork.com. But there are aspects of biodynamic farming that are really kind of difficult. Speaking as a former physicist with a really good grounding in science before I became an architect, I find rather difficult to embrace. It's more than just a balanced landscape or a self-contained environment that is self-renewing. It's more than that. There are certain kinds of supplements that must be added to the soil. There is a biodynamic farmer in upstate New York named K.K. Haspel. Let's hear from her directly with an explanation of biodynamic farming. Track 6, please.
The biodynamic preparations, it's the only thing that'll really heal the earth. It's actually way beyond organics. It's like a holistic approach to organics. The biodynamics will actually even eat things like radioactivity and other pesticides and poisons that might have been in your soil. We've got a shot at transforming all the property, all the land, all the soil that's been abused over all these years, and healing it and bringing back to balance, because that's what the biodynamics does. The silica is ground up quartz. You can imagine a magnifying glass. And all the crystals and all the refraction of that. And what it does is it refracts the light. So what you're doing with this is you're catching all of the cosmic forces and putting them into a concentration like a beam of light. This little teaspoon and this 3 gallons of water here will do a whole acre. It's actually taken and put in a cow horn, and quartz is ground up in a mortar and pestle until it's as fine as you can see how fine these granules are. And it's like a dust. You stuff the silica ground up into the cow horn and you bury it in the summer when the light is the most intense in the earth. People who had been farming the same way for hundreds and hundreds of years were now being told, you know, to put these other fertilizers out on their property. And they kept noticing things were going downhill rapidly. So they asked Steiner, who he's sort of a clairvoyant and a seer, and I believe that the plants talked to him and they told him things. In 1924, he gave a series of 8 lectures, and farmers from all over came, and that series of 8 lectures is the foundation of biodynamics.
Yeah. So it's not surprising to me, at least, that the reputation of Steiner suffered a bit towards the end of the 20th century. You know, at that point when people really believe in these biodynamic supplements of burying silica in a cow horn under your crop in the summer, planting crops on top of it, and then digging it up in the fall so that it can, recharge itself. That's beyond science into a belief system. Now, there are some people who believe that if you expect something to turn out in a certain way, that your own personal karma will cause that effect that you expect to be demonstrated. From what I've read, it's impossible to prove whether an organic farming approach that's got the biodynamic supplements does any better than one that's just simply organic, where there's a balance of nutrients going back and forth. I will leave that to the food experts at Heritage Radio Network. But I have to say that Rudolf Steiner was certainly a man of passions and interests, and had a real fire within, which then got me thinking of another little wonderful song from Carmina Burana, which is called Estuans Interius. It's all in medieval Latin, mind you, which has got just a wonderful, wonderful lyric. Let's listen to Håkon Haggegård singing Estuan Interius. Just about sums up how I feel about architecture some days, where I feel that some of our colleagues in the profession are so trapped in their own headspace and not living in the real world. It makes my heart ache. Because, you know, looking at the life of Steiner and this one trend informing the next project produced such rich architecture, which then informed all of these other activities in a way that I think really leads to greatness in architecture, not just interesting how it looks, but truly great architecture that operates on many, many, many different levels. So, my friends, I would urge you, live in your bodies. Don't just live in your heads. There was that last of the lyric here is, Mortuus in animus, curam gero cutis. My soul is dead, so I shall look after the flesh. You know, people here at Heritage Radio Network know how to live in their bodies. Let me tell you, this is a rocking bunch, and I'm very pleased to be part of the effort, spreading the worldwide message of growing the movement, of considering all aspects of sustainable life. Straight from the Garden of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. This has been where we have been burning down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and we've been brought to you by Acme Smoked Fish. And I look forward to speaking with you again. I think we've done for now. Good night. Be well.